There was like a public school, you were saying, well, like Passage to India.
Well, I'm going to what I mean. Palestine was the least smart of the places to which the colonial office sent its people. If you were any good, you went to Sudan, India, wherever it might be. Palestine was a rather mandated territory, but rather obscure. So the officials were not top officials. They were missionaries, like all British officials were then. They really believed in improving the lives of the natives. Their motives were perfectly good. They were not coarse imperialists. But it was like a public school in this sense. The boys were Arabs. The masters were English. There was a Jewish house, because we were living at this period where one had to have one. For some reason, not quite clear to some of the masters that the Jewish boys were different from the other boys. So that's why they were cleverer. Yeah. Secondly, they were pasty-faced and didn't play games. The other boys were fresh and young and vigorous, played games, had natural human emotions, well, in a way, pretty easy to get on with, and one could try to lift their status. They were poor, they were ignorant. Their offenders were charming and extremely agreeable and civilized and polished and dignified. The Jews were ugly, not dignified, arrogant, came to their own country, couldn't understand why they weren't given the whole of it, you see, and so on, didn't care about the Arabs at all. This irritated the English, naturally, the officials, who took against them in a big way. Partly like school where the boys are clearly cleverer than the masters, which itself humiliates the masters.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
It makes it impossible situation. Impossible situation. Now, moreover, they were trained to believe that there were whites and blacks. Now, what were the Jews? What were they? If they came from England, they were presumably white. German, yes. Now, they came from Russia, it wasn't absolutely clear what they were, Poland. They came from Tashkent, they were certainly black. They came from Morocco, it's clear they were black. But somehow there was something uncertain. They were like Pavlov's dogs. They couldn't salivate and bark at the same time. So schizophrenia began. And if you kicked an Arab down the stairs, that was the end of it. But if you kicked a Jew down the stairs, the next thing which happened was the boys would write to their parents in America. And their parents in America would write to one of the governors whom they knew. And then an inquiry, you see, if you kicked a Jew, you might know someone in America, would write to Mr. Justice Brandeis, who would write.
And then you'd be in trouble.
Nothing mastered like less than having governors suddenly start interfering as I was getting into school. See? So it was very, very uncertain about the Jews and awkward. Moreover, they thought they were wrong, and the Arabs had that, and they took a straight anti-Zionist position, which was perfectly natural. The Arabs were the natives. The Jews were these absurd invaders. Why, what's all this about? Balfour Declaration was obviously absurd, and a crime, and a mistake. I mean, that's all that's. The only people who were more is in favor, tired old Somerset Maugham-ish sort of officials who were bored by the Arabs and bored by their colleagues and amused by the Jews.
Yeah.
There were one or two people like that.
Yeah.
But they were sort of rather exhausted, rather cynical.
Yeah. What physical recollections do you have of Palestine as a place in 34? Where do you remember staying?
Well, I stayed in the King David Hotel Jerusalem, which was a hotel which was part of Shepherd's Hotel Cairo, which was part of a chain.
Yeah.
The servants were black Nubians in long white sort of shirts.
Yeah.
And it was a straight imperial hotel. And the bar was full of British officials. And I knew, now I forget to tell you, I did know a man called Tommy Hodgkin, who failed to get into All Souls when I did. He was secretary of the High Commissioner. And I knew him in Oxford quite well. And I stayed with him. He was a communist at that time, but that was hidden. He was a member of the party. That wasn't
his name again?
Hodgkin.
Hodgkin. Oh, yes, you Thomas mentioned him
Hodgkin.
Earlier.
Yeah. Oh, Thomas Hodgkin.
Any relation of the Hodgkin?
Yes, yes, all of them. His brother worked in the Times, called Edward Hodgkin. His cousin is a biologist at Cambridge, who's Master of Trinity.
Yeah.
His father was Prophet of Queens, and so on. You see?
And he gave you an introduction to British colonial society.
I stayed with him. I stayed with him in the Austrian hospice. I didn't give an introduction to anybody, but I talked to him. We came in on donkeys riding in on Friday afternoon, but stoned by religious Jews, rather like Christ. And we came in. You see?
This was in Jerusalem.
Jerusalem. He has worked in the secretariat. He was a private secretary, High Commissioner, Sir Arthur Walker. He was 1,000% anti-Zionist.
But not anti-Semitic?
No, because he was a communist. Well, I wasn't allowed to be. Fundamentally, yes. But in fact, restrained himself. I'll tell you a story about him, it'll tell you what I mean. When he was discovered he had to resign, he then led an Arab delegation to London. And there was this bus strike or something. And the Arab delegation said, why don't you just shoot them? We can't have disruption. Communist unions. He then went to Africa and became a tremendous sort of pro-Ghana man, Fred Nkrumah movement. Stayed there longer than Colin Cruz O'Brien, who was head of the university. But he was sort of left-wing, pro-native, sentimental, and pro-native, big affair of Balliol, after some sort of colonial studies. Now, he was a perfectly nice man.
But
I got the full impact, what British officials felt. Now, he knew some of these people, and I used to have drinks with them. They were cautious with me. The only people who didn't mind the Jews were the intelligence officers who cooperated with them to find out what the Arabs were at. But all the rest, the head of education, I remember, I can't remember his name, just loathed them quite open.
You met German Jews there, and what I'm trying to understand is what you said earlier, which was your sense
they were bewildered.
That Palestine, the Zionism somehow reduced your anxieties about what was happening in
Europe. No, I'll tell you. I was so pleased about what was happening in Palestine and so happy about Jews going there that the idea of their being persecuted in Germany didn't hit me as hard as it might, because they weren't being killed as far as I knew then. And they could get out if they took their property, gave their property to Germans. I mean, there was a terrible numerous clauses imposed by the British, but people with property could get out.
Yeah.
Most German Jews had some. So I thought in 1934-35 there was a chance we'd escape. They didn't think they were doomed, physically doomed. But then later, of course, I realized we were done for.
And later means when?
1937-38.
Really?
When they were caught.
Kristallnacht.
Just before Kristallnacht, yes. Mm. Because it's clear that they couldn't all get out as easily as before. There was a traffic with Palestine. It's one of the darkest pages of Zionist history, was a collaboration with the Nazi authorities. Because the Jews out is perfectly honorable, but it doesn't look right.
Yeah.
So like Teddy Kollek should go to Vienna to interview Eichmann. Okay. But getting Jews out, it's perfectly proper. But
a nightmare.
But I knew nothing of that then. I didn't know Weizmann. I didn't know any Zionist leaders. I was at Oxford. And knew very few Jews, let me tell you. Among friends, very few Jewish friends.
What, this is the final question, because you have to go in a minute somewhere else. But what did your mum and dad, your mother and father, make of you now? You are now a fellow at All Souls. You've now moved into the Oxford world. Did your mother and father come to see you at
Yes.
Oxford?
Yes, they had no idea what this meant. They didn't know what All Souls was. And it was clear to them when I came back. My father was frightfully excited. He knew that it meant something. Because his business friends told him. It was very, very... In those days, All Souls was much grander than it is now. Frightfully. It was perhaps the absolute top peak. Perhaps it's a blue ribbon or bluest of blue ribbons.
Right.
You see, many people got tenders and called the intellectual aristocracy of England. I can't tell you there was no justification, in fact. But it is true, as I told you before, that if you wanted to know how England was governed, members of the governing class called Souls,
they were there.
Highly systematic. They were there. And you could discover from that conversation, because it's very English, in front of the junior fellows, they love talking freely.
Yeah.
And you could disapprove of them and dislike them. But you knew you were in touch with the governing classes in a very direct way. Very. I mean...
Now what did your... But the question was, did your mother and father come up to see you at Oxford?
Oh, certainly.
See your
certainly.
World?
No, not my world. That happened later. No. They used to come and have lunch with me or something. And if I had friends, then I introduced them. But they weren't part of that world, and it didn't really connect. But in vacations, I stayed with them. Of course, always. Vacations, I stayed with my parents. In London, they knew what my life was like. They met my better than, especially three or four of my best friends. They certainly knew quite well.
Yeah. What did your mother think of your success, your elevation?
They were pleased. Mm. That's all I could say. I was the apple of their eye. I had no brothers or sisters.
Yeah.
And they were pleased with that. And they suddenly realized I got into a world where I was all right. I was paid a salary. I was regarded as all the grand.
Yeah.
And they were very extremely satisfied. They had no idea what it really was.
Yeah.
My father had a much better idea than my mother. My mother was a simple Russian Jewess, and I think not aware of these things. She didn't know how it was different from other places. She knew Oxford was marvelous. That's about all. But then, when the war began, in 1940, when I was sent to America for the first time, to Russia, as I thought, the Blitz began. So I arranged my father to live in my rooms in New College. My mother couldn't live there because women were not allowed, so she lived in the boarding house next door. My father met all my colleagues in New College and outside, made great friends with them, it was great success. They used to drop into my rooms, talk to my father. I was surprised but pleased. David Cecil and he got on beautifully. So in a way, they stayed in Oxford for 3 years.
Right.
My parents, yes.
Right.
You see, because they were away from London. They used to go occasionally back to the house in London.
Yes.
But it was a comfortable for them. Because of the Blitz and post-Blitz, they used to come to Oxford. By this time, there was a Jewish community there of people like themselves, but also taking shelter there. And they knew them. Lord Samuel suddenly appeared. He used to come to tea. Herbert.
Yes.
That sort of thing, was you what I mean? So in that sense, they understood my form of life. But not until then. They then knew Oxford, its streets, its houses, its inhabitants, dons, although they got it extremely well. I mean, my mother had a very comical description of the christening of David Cecil's youngest son, in St. Mary's.
Yes, I can imagine.
To which we went.
Yeah.
And so on, you see. So that's the answer to that. I went to lunch, 10 Downing Street, this year. I think it was this year, maybe last year, when the President of Israel came on a state visit. We got Herzog, whom I knew his father. We were all out to Downing Street, and old Mrs. Rothschild was, Mrs. James Rothschild was there. And she was extremely old, and very distinguished and grand. Mrs. Thatcher said how pleased she was to welcome this wonderful woman. And she was obviously expecting to say something. So she got up and said, the last time that I had luncheon in 10 Downing Street was when Mr. Asquiz was kind enough to invite me. Sat down, that was 1915.
Oh, incredible.
70 years before. It was sweet.
Yes.
Asquiz liked her very much.
Yes.
She's a pretty girl. Asquiz is rather susceptible. So she died, I'm afraid she died 2 days ago.
When was the last time that you saw her?
The last time I physically saw her was 3 days ago.
And how was she then?
Well, her eyes were closed. Her mouth was open. You see, she was dying of a heart attack. She didn't hear what I said, I'm sure. People thought she did, but no. I just left her side and uttered a few words. She was perfectly all right, she was breathing. She was quite comfortable. But she died about 9 hours later.
And your association with her goes back?
To James, her husband. That goes back, that's quite amusing. 1933, I was elected to Paul Scholes College. 32. James the Rothschild, who was a Graz engineer, they really the only one among the Rothschilds, I mean a sort of racing figure, friend of, member of what they call the other club, friend of Churchill, Effie Smith, Beaverbrook, Lord Jowett. I mean, I never think people talked well, cats rather, but was a terrific figure in English life. He's a liberal member of parliament. I can tell you a little about him. He's just to convey the kind of person he was. He went to school in Paris. His father started the colonies in Paris then, the Baron Edmond. Yes. And the other Rothschild thought he was stark, staring, mad. Rather embarrassment. And they were French and so on, what was all this. And then he went to school during the Dreyfus case, where being called Rothschild was perhaps not very useful. And Cotson was so conceived such hatred of upper class French circles, which his parents moved, that he left Paris, very in a sort of rebellious manner, went to Australia, where he became a cow puncher. Punched a certain number of cows, north to south. His parents were absolutely beside themselves. So they wrote him letters begging him to come home and discuss his future. He wouldn't come further than Argentina, which was halfway. We met them. The Baron Edmond finally persuaded him to come back to Europe, but not to France. So he went to England, went to Cambridge. He got a third-class degree, I think, but he was a friend of the Prince of Wales. He played polo. And he was very amusing and very dictatorial. He was had a strong will, and he did what he liked. He really was sort of what the Russians call Sumas Broad. I mean, you see, like an old son, and imperious is what he was. And then he went to play golf, and he was 31, saw this girl of 17, married her. She was the daughter of a man called Pinto. Her father, grandfather, was a very rich Jew from Egypt. She was completely English in character and temperament, remained like an English lady, Church of England character. I wouldn't have known she was Jewish, except that she was. And then he was a Zionist, James, because his father was, and looked after the colonies with him. What polo and all that, yes. And he certainly was relevant for the Balfour Declaration. She and he opened doors to Weizmann in London, in England generally. He had a country house, after all. He lived in Waddesdon. It was a tremendous house, now a National Trust. He knew useful people for Weizmann to know. I think he played a real part in all that. And then in 1918, there was a Zionist delegation, was led by Weizmann. The two officers attached to the delegation were Captain Ormsby Gore and Captain, maybe Major Rothschild, maybe Major Ormsby Gore. That was very typical. However, he was always looked after these colonies. But he was a dictator. And I used to tell him that his agents in Palestine, by bullying the unfortunate colonists in the name of the great benefactor, with the richest breeding grounds of communists in the whole of Palestine.
How did he take to that?
Very badly, but it was not untrue. Yes. When the parents are humiliated, the sons.
Yes, indeed. When did you meet them?
Now, when I was elected All Souls, he became very excited about that. The very idea of a Jew being elected All Souls, he knew what it meant. And I was immediately asked for lunch in 1933. My friend John Foster became my friend, was a friend of theirs, and I was driven to Waddesdon. I'd never been in a country house before in my life. There were footmen, it seemed to me, behind every chair. There was Mr. James, Baron James, who did never call himself Baron in England. Mr. James Rothschild, MP, Mrs. James Rothschild, was very gentle and quiet. Lord Victor Rothschild, later Lord Rothschild, Miss Rothschild, later Mrs. Lane, Elizabeth Flees, Venetia Montague, the widow of Edwin Montague, the minister in Hesketh's government, the chief whip of the Liberal Party, which was not very flourishing, but there was a man with a large red tie overflowing, and there was a man called Scatters Wilson, who was a sort of man about town of a dubious character. They were all present, and I'd never seen such luxury or such grandeur. And then I was left behind with Miss Rothschild and Victor Rothschild. We made friends quite independently, and I knew them for the rest of my life. However, he was very amusing, very agreeable. Before I car came to fetch me at All Souls, first thing the chauffeur did was to produce a huge cigar box and offer me a cigar. When I left, Waddesdon has marvelous treasures in it. The rooms are locked up. All of it, about 10 rooms are open. The rest is under lock and key and other covers. I was offered a cigar again, the side entrance to which one's brought by car, not the grand entrance now. That's how I came to meet him, and saw him ever after. I used to visit him in London. He used to ask me meals occasionally, sometimes Waddesdon, sometimes London. I didn't know him intimately, but I was a friend. I mean, I was dropped in, so to speak. From time to time, he would send me messages saying, why couldn't I come and have a cup of tea?
When did he die?
57. He had, I think, towards the end of his life, kept on falling off. I think he fell off his office horse about twice, playing polo. He looked like an antediluvian monster, extremely distinguished, but not exactly beautiful. Huge nose, enormous eyeglass, endless caricatures of him. He was a public personality of the first order, but the great thing was he wasn't what's called a gentleman. Yeah. And very, did what he liked.
What does gentleman mean to you?
Well, that. That he was the opposite of ignoble. I don't know what noble is, but he was not ignoble. Gentleman means somebody. You know what Desmond McCarthy defines a gentleman as? A man who never gives pain unwittingly, undeliberately, and does not count the change, the bill.
Indeed.
That's his idea.
I see both of those clearly.
That's his idea. What?
Yes, I see both of those clearly.
We see these clearly. No, I think by a gentleman I really mean someone who is opposite of what is called ignoble.
Yes.
Difficult to know what ignoble is, but we all know what it is.
Yes.
Can only be done by pointing to instances.
Yes.
It's a social and moral quality.
Yes.
But it's social in the sense that it wouldn't exist, I think, if all men were equal. It goes with certain authority in society.
Yes.
I mean, it's therefore not a purely moral. When people say, you know, he's quite a little gentleman, about people, or what Lord Halifax said to me about Truman, in fact, quite a little gentleman.
Oh, really?
That is patronizing and
yes.
So on. The lower classes don't have gentlemen in that sense.
Yes.
People attribute this to them,
yes.
Because they think it means honest and dignified and
they have manners. Yes, they have virtues, but they're not gentlemanly.
Gentlemanly is partly social category, entailing a difference of class.
Yes.
That's what it means to me. I mean, I wouldn't describe a saint who happens to belong to the proletariat as a gentleman.
Yes. I think we should...
Herzen knew what it meant. When he moved into a place called Orsett House, near Paddington, which is now has a plaque on it, he says in his autobiography, I felt a gentleman had lived there. He took it.
I think we should...
Stop.
No, we should stop, but yes, we'll stop.
One more thing about the Jews. What I'm ashamed of is this. I went to Washington in 1914, again 41. After all, there was this German who employed Jews in his factory and saved them, but who a novel was written.
Yes.
He went to Switzerland.
Schindler.
I think it was Schindler, maybe somebody else, who went to Switzerland during the war and told the representative of the World Jewish Congress about what was happening about the gas chambers. Must have been 43. I think the final solution was only decided on in 42. So it was late 43 or beginning 43. This man sent a telegram to Rabbi Stephen Wise in New York reporting this. Stephen Wise reported this to Roosevelt. Nothing happened. People sometimes didn't believe it. Thought it might be invented. It's not really credible. Such things were going on. But my wife's father, who was a French Jew for these purposes, moving among in sort of upper class refugee circles, did know something about it. Someone told him. He certainly told Aline. There were rumors that something of this kind was going on. I never heard anything about it until something like January 45. I knew Weizmann, I knew Frankfurter, a new Ben Cohen. Quite some may have left America by then, I admit, 43
people. Did you know Stephen Wise?
Yes, but not that I mean I met him, but didn't really know him. Anyhow, I never heard about this. I mean, I lived insulated in British embassy circles, all right.
Yes.
But I did know Jews, and I met Zionists, not very frequently. But I met them, you see. I only learned of it. I'm sure it was printed on page 32 of the New York Times, or something, somewhere.
But can you remember the occasion Israeli in papers January 1945 which brought
no,
it up?
No, no, no. I cannot. I just am aware that I became aware like everybody else.
Yes.
The real thing was when American troops reached these places,
and
the photographs and so on. But I think I knew about it before. I think I'd heard about some gas chambers in early 45. Certainly not before. And everyone else, lots of people must have known. In lots of countries. I mean, you see, and that makes me feel ashamed. That I don't know. I mean, I just wasn't told. I wouldn't have disbelieved it.
You wouldn't have?
No. I thought Nazis were capable of anything. The one thing which I did do, which made me unpopular, people said, why didn't they bomb the trains carrying the refugees? Why, I mean, the prisoners. Why didn't they bomb the concentration camps or Belsen? Already by 45, I think, I realized that they wanted to kill the Jews more than they wanted to win the war. Because they went on killing Jews to the last moment. In 45, they were losing the war on all fronts. Still, they didn't stop. Therefore, it convinced me that if they did bomb the trains, well, I wouldn't have known that in 42, but by 44 I knew it, sort of. That if they did bomb the trains, they'd rebuild them in no time. If they bombed the camps, they'd kill quite a lot of Jews, some Germans, but they wouldn't allow that to stop, ever. What they could have done, and didn't do, but I didn't want to talk about that, it's not part of what we're talking about. They could have threatened the Central Europeans and the Balkans, who were not so sure the Germans would win the war after a certain date, say in 43. If they'd been bullied and told if they went on handing over Jews, terrible punishments come upon them, some of them might have quailed.
The Hungarians?
Yes, and Romanians, Hungarians, yes, anybody who like, well, that's what. Do you see what I mean? Albanians, as it were. People who are handing over. Austrians, no good. But these were anti-Semitic, but not particularly exterminatory. You see what I mean? Some of them would have been frightened of retribution, you see? And some of them might have tried to establish a record for themselves as having saved Jews. Might. Wasn't done.
I mean... See, I know this takes us away from our subject, I do find it genuinely difficult as a historian to put myself back in the world before the facts were known. That is, to the world in which you confront these realities in January of 45, I am sure that a large part of me would say it just isn't
possible. It's a pure, like the First World War. I mean, all the cadaver factories, invention. It's a piece of gruel propaganda.
Yes.
Gruel propaganda, atrocity propaganda.
Yes.
It's typical invention.
Yes, babies on bayonets, as it were.
Babies on bayonets. Exactly, lamps, which were made. Lamp shades were made, but why would one have believed it?
Yeah.
You see, I agree with you. I think a great many people dismissed it. Frankfurter did. That wasn't to do with me, because I only discovered it much later. There was a Jew who got out of Hungary. One of these Jews.
Karski.
Not the famous one.
No,
what?
No.
Karski was a Finn.
Yeah.
That's another story. No. I mean, a man called Joel. Joel something. Anyhow, you see.
Went to see Frankfurt.
But he'd met him with some other Hungarian. He drew and told Frankfurt that this was happening. I didn't believe it was a Frankfurt and drove him out. Nonsense. Can't be true. I didn't know he visited him. I didn't know he said he'd never told me the story. I discovered that, what, 2 or 3 years ago when the man read a book. You see? So you're right. The general reaction would have been impossible. But by 45, I believe it. I would have believed it. Now, my conception of Nazis, I knew about Hitler in the 20s. Because I was a reader of the Jewish Chronicle. And the name of Hitler began to crop up in 1923. And I knew there was this violent anti-Semite in Germany long before most people had heard of him.
Yeah.
I was aware of him.
And the Jewish Chronicle is tracking him, as it were.
More reporting time to time. He made a speech and was arrested in Munich, or had made a violent speech. The Jewish Chronicle was full of nothing but news about anti-Semitism all over the place. Yeah. In those days.
Thank you.
Right, let's stop now.